And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to Rates and Barrels. It's Monday, October 3rd. The season should be over today in our minds, but it is not. There are still 3 days worth of games. There are still one playoff spot. I think that is actually up for grabs, and I feel like it is slipping away from my grasp every minute. You know, every single minute of every day, I feel worse and worse about the Brewers' chances of playing postseason.
I have three leagues that are going to come down to like the last day. So that's my equivalent of your Brewers feeling, which I'm like my main, which is has the most money riding on it, goes from second to fourth every day, like in the back. And I'm just like, no, I'll take third at this point.
I finally got clipped out of the money, I think, in my big auction. I think I'm just far enough back now where I'm not going to catch the teams in cash. But I have other leagues where I'm being chased. So I'm just trying to hold on for a few more days and make it a pretty good season. So we'll see.
I may have this regret. I chose to put... I really need K's, and it's like really close in K's and wins. And so I had $2 left. So I made a copy of two transactions, right? Where it was like all the starters that would start. And we're talking about Louis Varland was like the last name on. And it was only like, there was like three or four pitchers that I wanted to roster that had a start left in the season.
Yeah, not many.
And so I put four starters together, and they made a copy of it for the second dollar, right? And then I was looking around. I was like, "Wow, you know, it's pretty close in homers and RBIs too." And I kind of like what Michael Massey's doing. And so then I put Michael Massey on top of the second one. And if I lose by, if I'm out of second by like one or two Ks, I'm going to be killing myself.
Oh no!
But of course, like you know, the last 3 days were also terrible because, you know, somebody like Drew Rasmussen. You know, it says he's scheduled to pitch against Boston on the last day.
No.
I don't think that's happening. And I think it could happen to anybody. Like, I've got John Heasley, and I'm like, well, it's a young guy. He needs the outing. But anything could happen between now and Wednesday where they're just like, nah, he's got a blister. Like, nah, he's not feeling good. We're just going to do a bullpen game or something. You know, like...
Yeah.
I'm staring at this like last 3 days being like, who of these guys is actually like Ken Waldachuk probably going to start on the last day of the season, but yeah, maybe not.
I think with someone like Waldachuk, it's a little easier to determine whether or not he's hit a predetermined innings limit, because if they weren't going to start him, what
they
incentive do the A's have
now,
yeah,
right?
To hide that? Yeah. Whereas, you know, a team that is trying to reset everything for the postseason, or maybe it just has innings concerns about it, someone they're relying on, they might make a decision to go shorter with a start. Oh, I want you to throw, but you're going to throw two, you're going to throw three.
That, like Rasmussen could just throw two innings.
Yeah, just to keep the arm loose. Yeah, he's not going to pitch again for a few more days, so just throw one inning and be done. Throw your side
that
session
the worst case
in a game.
And then all my draft and holds, it's like, well, let me take out all these useful starters and put in like Merriweather and Griffin Jacks.
Yeah.
Because they're not pitching. Three leagues coming down to it where I can finish. If it all goes right, I could win two and finish second in the main. That's how close it is. If it all goes wrong, I could go third, second, fourth.
Third, second, fourth. Okay. Well, that's still pretty bad. That's a tough way to go out given where you're at right now.
Yeah.
If you were climbing to those positions, I think you'd say that's a pretty good year. But if you slipped to those positions, you'd be furious because you saw what could have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of my leagues is funny because we do combined roto and head-to-head. So in that one, I'm jockeying for like anywhere from third to first. I think it's still on the board, but I'm also in the head-to-head finals. And so it's actually really interesting because it makes it harder to do things like punt a stat, right? Or like, you know, even this head-to-head matchup, I'm so close in the roto that I don't need saves. I could go to an all holds lineup if I wanted. But in my head-to-head matchup, I need another save. So makes it for interesting, like, sort of tactical decisions. I kind of like it. It does require work. Like, we actually have to have somebody with engineering, like, programming skills, because they're actually taking stats from the API from CBS and creating a roto leaderboard for our head-to-head league. That's the Pitchfork League. I like that one.
Take fantasy baseball and make it more complicated. Require more advanced skills to play.
You need a programmer on you in your league.
What's wrong with me is that I'm like, that sounds pretty fun. And I know that the correct way to get more people to play this game is to go to the other direction.
Kind of, not those kind of barriers to entry. Oh, I'm sorry. You don't have a programmer in your league? Well, you're just going to have to play 10-team head-to-head then.
Yes.
Good luck with that.
Auctions with blindfolds on. Like, no technology. Yeah. I mean, I'm sitting on a few leads right now. I think if the season ended right now, I'd win 7 different leagues. I don't think that's going to... I mean, something's got to go... enough of those are close enough where it could end up being 4. And
That's better than me. I'm going to win like 3 or 4. It's not been my best year, but my average finish, I think, is still going to be something like 3 out of 15.
That's good. So, that's a good year.
It's a good year.
Be happy
and
with
like
that.
Any year that you like set a points record and by 6 points in like a league that's been around since 1975, like I guess I'll take it.
Yeah, that's a good one. All right. Well, the main focus of this episode is going to be reliever review because the season is almost over. We're going to start the series now because if we didn't, I think it would take until like January to finish it. So the hope is that we'll be able to wrap this up in the next
in January,
6 or 7 weeks.
Need to preview.
Right. We put a P in front and then we go forward.
We just start all over again.
So relievers, my dumb way of thinking was they can't change that much in 3 days. I mean, hopefully everyone just stays healthy, because I guess that's the one thing that would really change our minds about, even still, from a value perspective, it wouldn't change the season enough for it to matter. We always take a look back, kind of think about what was going on back during draft season. If you go back to draft season, in this case, I was just looking at the first week of April because of the delayed start to the 2022 season. You might remember it was Josh Hader and Liam Hendricks as the big two. They were the consensus top two closers. They were often going around pick 30 if we're talking about NFBC leagues, probably a little bit later than that if we're talking more about Yahoo, CBS, ESPN type home leagues.
Zero shares. Actually, I lie. In my main, I have Hader. I picked him up 2 weeks ago on waivers. So,
wow.
Zero. That's actually, I mean, I think that is a little bit illustrative of Josh Hader's season.
That's the English pronunciation, right?
No, sorry.
Okay. Yeah. No, it's okay. I'll just.
Hader did not return value above.
He's pretty bad. I'm looking at on the auction calculator.
Hader was a $0 pitcher according to the auction calculator. That's a big yikes for me, dude. And well, you know what's funny is that his stuff is still pretty much there. You know, I might have picked him if he'd slid to me anywhere, but the command was legendarily bad this year.
It was. I think we've wanted to know for a few weeks what did the end of the season look like, and what will the postseason look like for Hader? If he goes back to dominant looking self.
Oh, he's the one that actually there could be a lot of change between now and and the time we start doing the previews.
Take a small sample of second half innings and tack on another small sample of postseason innings and draw a meaningful conclusion from that. Good luck. The best I can do is if you go back to September 7th, he's 5-for-5, I believe, in save chances during that span. 12 Ks and 8 2/3 innings. Only one walk, no homers allowed. That looks like Hader.
Command is, yeah, it's command. I mean, he still doesn't have great command. Like, he'll be, like, trying to throw a pitch up and in, and it'll end up out and, you know, out and up, you know? But I think he's either finding better places to miss or just getting, you know, refining the command just a little bit, so.
Right. All of this is to say, I've started to sketch out those 2023 rankings a little bit. I think Hader is still going to be in what was previously the circle of trust, which is about 8 to 10 closers that we wanted to have on our teams. That's the furthest he could fall, and there's a chance that he's still probably within that top 5.
5th or something? Yeah, 4th?
Yeah, on the rough draft, he's 7th right now, but that's like 7th with an up arrow.
Mm-hmm.
It still looks pretty good. Most of the guys in the top group are still going to be in or near the top group. The order is just different. I mean, Hendricks has done a lot since coming off the IL to slowly push himself back up the board as well. I could look at Liam Hendricks right now and say that he has a case to probably be closer 2, and closer 3 off the board.
He ended up in a relatively down year, 7th on the auction calculator. However, when you look, and here's the auction calculator results. It was Clase first, Helsley second, Edwin Diaz third, Daniel Bard fourth, Jordan Romano fifth, Kenley Jansen sixth, Liam Hendricks seventh. So there are guys ahead of him that I will not put ahead of him. The shape of Kenley Jansen's season doesn't leave me in a good spot with him. Daniel Bard still pitches in Colorado. So those two, at the very least, are going to go slot behind Hendricks. So I don't know. It's somewhat tempting when you look at it to be like, man, that's just the order. You know, it's like Clase, Helsley, Diaz, Romano, Hendricks, Hader. Like, argue me off of that, you know?
I think you have to put Diaz at the top of your closer rankings right now. Not because of the entrance video or the entrance music, but because the strikeout rate is just on its own level. And you're talking about a guy that has comparable control to the other guys in this group, even though it's slightly a higher walk rate than Hendricks and Presley, and it's a higher walk rate than Class A. Just the best all-around closer right now based on skills. I was looking at your pitching model. Things look fine there too. This group stacks up very similarly to each other across the board.
Class A has better stuff plus and better location plus, so he ends up as a better pitching plus candidate than Edwin Diaz, but it's instructive to remember that stuff plus is trained against all outs, where, you know, fantasy is based on strikeouts. So Class A's cutter is an elite sort of run suppression pitch, but isn't necessarily one that returns as many strikeouts as Diaz will have. So yeah, I can agree with that. I was speaking a little bit more generally of like what my top seven, who's in my top
seven.
It.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree.
I think there's going to be some ordering concerns. Whereas like Helsley, how much do you worry about someone who's sort of come on the scene so quickly? His pitching plus, though, is very good. His stuff plus is very good. Romano's had some ups and downs, but you know, going into the season, I was always trying to get someone that you referred to, the circle of trust. I was always trying to get like the last one of that. So going into the season in my drafts, I had a goal of getting as much Ryan Presley and Jordan Romano as I could.
Yeah. And until Presley had that knee injury pop up, I was very much in on Presley. He was the guy I wanted the most. I think he's my most rostered pitcher across all my leagues this year. And that was with a late season move away from him and even backing off some of the top end closers because the prices kept ticking up even more as we got closer to opening day. But Presley's velocity has come back a bit in the second half. So I think any lingering concerns we had through the first half about the velo being down, those have been erased. And he's got the contract. I don't really see warts there.
Even when his velo was down, his stuff plus was decent because he's got an amazing breaking ball.
Yeah.
You know, it's like why Rich Hill has just always still had pretty good stuff plus, because he's just a great breaking ball. So I think I believe in him. I do think he's maybe last in the circle of trust this year. You know, maybe Hader and him are last in the top 7-8. Because of, you know, just over time, relievers lose velocity and their performance is tied more to their velocity. So just having a season where he had a lost velocity, you know, that worries me. Plus, he's an old reliever and there's going to be some effect of the pitch clock, I believe. And I think that if there is a pitch clock effect, it's going to be mostly to older relievers. So, you know, all those combined, I think he's still in the circle of trust, but he's right at the end. And I have to say, the end of the circle of trust is where seasons can be like team, like you can lose your league. Like I kind of think that, because if I look back at where the end of the circle of trust was going into the season, just looking at this, for me, Kimbrel, Chapman, and Gallegos. So I liked Romano, and you're saying that he had sort of an 85 ADP going in.
Yeah, about 85.
Chapman 82, Kimbrel 88, Gallegos 117. That was death, dude. That was an awful place to live. And I plucked Romano out of it. I feel good about that. I do have leagues where I missed Romano and ended up with Kimbrel and Gallegos, and that was no good. So, you know, it may be instructive once you find, like, you're identifying your circle of trust going into the second season, it may be instructive to really hone in on the second to last guy so that you're not getting, you know, you're not getting that Kimbrel situation or that Chapman situation, especially with this tweak of like going to a pitch clock and these older pitchers being slower. Like, as bad as Aroldis Chapman has been, do we think he's going to get better? Like, Presley could be a Kimbrel or Chapman. You know what I mean? Like, you're just talking about, they're talking about a guy, like, Kimbrel and Chapman still look good in stuff plus model, right? But they're older. They've shown some weaknesses. Is Helsley, is there any chance that that Presley is the next Chapman or Kimbrel for next year?
Always a chance. I think the age argument is the best possible argument you can make.
Skills, he seems better, but
the skills difference too, though. I think about Chapman's always having issues with walks. He's always had that. Kimbrel in more recent years has struggled with his command. Like, those guys had, but they had, even though they had even higher strikeout ceilings, they did have a clearer downside when they were good. Whereas Presley should age more gracefully, but you're right, the changing variable with the pitch clock is at least worth keeping on our minds. I expect him to be in my group of closers that I still want, especially if the price isn't higher than it was this year. If it actually comes down a little bit, I think that still is going to make a lot of sense.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I keep looking at Raisel Iglesias and thinking, what exactly did anyone do wrong by drafting him? This seems like a bad luck sort of outcome, that he was traded and went like a month without a save before he got traded just because the Angels weren't creating save chances. I'm convinced that there's nothing wrong in your process if you were drafting Iglesias in that range throughout this draft season, because skills-wise, he was still good.
Didn't you get some value out of him?
Yeah, you get a half season's worth. You got 17 saves. You got half as many saves as he had last season. Strikeout rate was down just a little bit from a year ago.
So
skills are still very good.
Back end top 20, looks like.
Which is disappointing given the extra
the investment
amount you had to pay. But at the same time,
like, he's hanging out with a lot of waiver wire closers like David Robertson, John Duran, and Jorge Lopez.
But what are you going to do? Take a look at some guy that has the job and good skills on a good team that gets drafted in the top 75 overall and say, oh, there's a chance this team's going to crater. And if they crater, they might actually trade him. We don't know. Like, that's not, there's nothing actionable there, I guess, is what I keep coming back to. That's just.
And what I like about Iglesias is that he could easily be the closer in Atlanta next year. And, you know, one thing that we just learned, I think, a little bit from Chapman and Kimbrel is that these older closers with poor command, like, it's pitching plus, actually. I have to remind myself all the time because I'm so into stuff plus. It's pitching plus that does really well predicting how a reliever does, right? It does. It is important to have command. And so if you look at Kimbrel, yeah, his stuff plus is still good. His pitch, his command is actually above average. It's a little bit surprising. But Chapman is the real obvious one where his stuff plus is still top 10 in the league. His location plus is 88.6. Like there's nobody else as low as that, you know? And even last year, he wouldn't have had that. So other really high stuff, low location guys that people might depend on next year. Clay Holmes is pretty bad. Ryan Stanek is pretty bad. Josh Hader has a 91 location plus. Maybe he's actually your next Aroldis Chapman, you know? So it is instructive to sort of remember that command matters. And that, especially with an older pitcher, they can't just outstuff their bad command at some point. I think that's the story of Chapman, really.
Right. And I think with Raisel Iglesias, we've talked about him before as a closer that doesn't have a prototypical closer's arsenal, right? More mm-hmm. pitches than most closers, with fastball, slider, change all being used heavily. That, mm-hmm. to me, gives him a softer landing as well. It's sort of like Presley. I do think you're right to put Hader and Chapman in the same bucket because of their command issues, because of their ceilings. Like, they seem like they'd be on more similar paths to each other. So,
but I still like the idea of identify a circle of trust, 5 to 7 pitchers that you like, that you think are number one closers and will keep the job all year, that sort of deal. And then don't buy the first two and don't buy the last two. That's the one, like, caveat I've tried to put, because I've been fairly successful with relievers this year. The model's been really great for that, and, you know, I think it's going to be again. But you know, when I made the mistake of being like, well, I'll just get this last guy in my circle of trust, right? Gallegos is in the circle of trust, right? No, he isn't. So I like this idea of, like, you know, trying to play the middle on that, because I'm still not going to buy a closer in the second or third.
Team intentions, I think, can still be pretty difficult to read. I mean, I think until recently, Gallegos was still showing up and getting a decent number of saves, even though I think a lot of the saves he was getting in August were on the back of Helsley pitching in front of him.
Helsley pitched twice.
Helsley got the win.
Oh, Helsley got the eighth, yeah.
And Gallegos ended up getting a save there. But I think 7 of the last 8 saves the Cardinals have generated have gone to Helsley in September. Mm-hmm. So that one might be tilting far enough in Helsley's favor where he ends up inside the circle, but maybe near that back end range. I thought Corey Knebel, from a skills perspective, because he'd done it before and because it looked like he was healthy a year ago, I actually thought that was a good fit in Philly. I thought he was a good second closer if you didn't get two out of the group initially, back when I was trying to get two from that first 8 to 10. I thought Taylor Rogers actually made a lot of sense in San Diego. The home run issues he's been dealing with more recently are a bit surprising to me. Yeah. I'm just not really sure how major league teams view him. I think I'm a little bit disoriented when it comes to understanding how he'll be used, because the Twins never really, they didn't always use him as a regular closer. The Padres did, but then the Padres were willing to trade him in the Hader deal. And then, of course, in Milwaukee, he ended up being a fallback option to Devin Williams after the trade. So I don't know if Rogers hits free agency and gets scooped up and some team says, you're our guy, go get 30 saves. I think he's capable of it in the right circumstances. I just don't know if I'm willing to take that chance, team unknown in the early part of the draft season.
Yeah, he's played his way out of any sort of circle of trust. You know, like he's at this point a guy that you pick up in the end game because you think he might end up closing for the Pirates, or you know, closing for somebody where he gets picked up. You know, I don't think he's second tier. But looking at that second tier, the thing that I think is just that's awful. And so I wanted to look real quickly at my leaderboard in the main for saves here. Dude, I got 58 saves. That's good for sixth. And this is a league where I kind of messed up. Like, I think this was a league where I had Gallegos or something. 77 is first place in saves. And that's not always instructive, because I was like, oh, that's the one guy who like bought, you know, Hendricks and like bought three closers really high, right? Maybe it is. I'm not actually looking at the details. I like to look about second or third. Like if you can get second or third in every category, then you're gonna win the league.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good way to look at it.
69 is third and 70 is second. So I think 70 saves is your benchmark. Now think about this. Let's say you do what I'm saying, and you've got the front two, you're not going to get, and the back two, and so you're getting someone that's third to fifth. You're getting Ryan Helsley, or you're getting who's going to be third to fifth. Maybe you get Hendricks again. You know, maybe you get, Presley would, I think, be at the back end. Let's say you just get Hendricks again, all right? You got the fourth best reliever on your board, and you got him in the fifth round or whatever. How many saves you're banking for? You thinking 35, 40.
Can you really project anyone for more than 30? Because even as great as Edwin Diaz has been on a team that's been battling for or holding on to first place most of the year.
You just spent to get a good one, right?
Yeah,
you're not skimping. Let's give you 35. Okay. That's half of the saves you need.
Right. Well, if you get two very good closers, you can get it from two. The odds of being right on both and getting them is hard.
This is my argument. Don't get a second closer. Like, don't buy in that tier. Listen how bad this is. This is the closers twos, right? Knebel, Rogers, Barlow. He's the good one, but
yeah, Scott Melanson, Barlow's pretty good. Yep.
Soto, Kittredge, McGee, Duvall, Barnes, Bednar, Trevino. Listen, what's your success rate there? It seems like it's less than 50%. We could count it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I mentioned 11, and I call the misses 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 out of 11 were misses.
How many of those players did we like based on skills, though?
Yeah, okay. I ended up with some of those hits. Like, you know, I liked Soto the best out of that group. Duvall was somebody I liked, but I was a little bit nervous that they wouldn't give him saves all year.
I think a lot of people liked Bednar. I don't know why he came out so cheap if so many people liked him, but people liked Bednar.
I didn't really like any of those other guys, but I did like, you know, Kittredge had some good stuff plus numbers. Barnes always has okay stuff plus numbers. And I had, you know, I don't know if I had a share of Rogers, but there wasn't a reason to hate Rogers. It was just, I don't like shopping in this tier is my overall point. You know what I mean? And 7 out of 11, even if you think you can identify the four, it's just not a good place to live. So you identify the four in the next group and then just wait forever, because that doesn't seem like it's worth investment. Like, what else went in the 150s? I'm sure there were some great position players and starting pitchers that went in the 150s.
Well, you're not dealing with role uncertainty with position players in that group. You know the players that are being drafted there as hitters, unless they are very young players or prospects, their playing time's not going to just disappear, or the aspect of their playing time that makes them relevant to our game isn't going to just vanish.
Yeah. I think I want to have one closer out of the top 75 picks. And then I'm going to take 125 picks off from taking closers. And then maybe jump in and do two. If I did that last year, you know, I would get Ryan Pressly or Jordan Romano, a lot of leagues like that. I would miss out on Bednar and Soto, which, you know, I had a lot of leagues that did have that. And then if I just started shopping at 200, now actually I could get Bednar at 200. Maybe Soto falls to me. He was 177 overall. But I could maybe double tap and get, I would get like Bednar and Barlow at 200 or Seawald, 288. Seawald. Should we not be afraid of picking the best reliever in a crowded bullpen?
That would be part of the best argument for only taking one in the circle. And let me back up even more. Like, I am very hesitant to go top shelf, pick 25, pick 30, pick 35 for Edwin Diaz or Class A or whoever ends up there. I agree with you that you want to get at least one within this group of seven or eight that we like to try and have a clear 30 with good ratios and a good K rate. And then watching out in this 100 to 200 range totally makes sense to me.
Landmine after landmine.
There's a chance that you'll identify a couple of relievers that do go in that range that you actually like, and if they're there at the appropriate time, you can take them. This is a general outline of a strategy. This is not a rigid, you must do this way. This is just a way to think about it. If you're waiting, I think you're probably taking two chances in what look like clear committees on guys with good skills. So that would be the Paul Sewald types, right? You have to get two players like that because there's a chance that one gets a smaller share than expected or gets no share at all. And then you're left with just the one closer you have. And if you're pushing 30 to 35 saves, you're probably sitting more like three to five standings points in the category, most likely, somewhere in that range. You're not at the bottom, but you're chasing on the wire throughout the season, which is fine because if you do find one, you'll get mid-pack, and you could still be okay mid-pack.
And how many do we find this year? I mean,
from out of nowhere.
Ryan Helsley, second best reliever.
Yeah, Ryan Helsley, for
second
sure.
Second best reliever. Fourth best reliever, Daniel Bard.
Clay Holmes.
Ninth is Evan Phillips, but that's... It's just... It's without the saves, you know? I'm not going to shop for that. We still
Felix
need
Bautista?
Yeah.
Out of nowhere.
Did Devin Williams get drafted a lot?
I think Williams was drafted, cut, and then picked up after the Tater trade.
Picked up again, yeah.
Right, because you can't wait forever.
Adam, Alexis Diaz are $6 pitchers with saves.
Jorge Lopez was basically either free at the end of the draft or quickly an early season pickup. He was valuable for a while. So they happen. They emerge.
A lot, all the time. I like this idea of, you know, the perfect bill in the perfect pen going, like, if I went back in time, it would be Romano at, you know, maybe I have to jump him a little bit to make sure I get him, especially in this thing that we're talking about. You said Romano went 85. That's sixth round?
Yeah. In a 15-teamer? Yeah, sixth round.
Let's say I take him at the end of the fifth. So Romano at 75. And then I don't jump Bednar or Soto, and I take one of them. I take Bednar or Soto at 205 or 215. Like, Bednar's at 215, right? It's not a good place to shop. Like, Joe Barlow, Robert Suarez, Paul Sewald, Bender? Who's Bender? Anthony Bender, Art Warren. If you shopped in there, you got a half season from Barlow and a full season from Sewald, but you also missed three times. So I would take one of those guys at 300. So that's my general approach.
Yeah, like, David Robertson was actually a decent value late too.
Yeah, Romano at 75. This is not revisionist, like, oh yeah, like anybody can look back and like create the perfect, like that's literally what my plan was. And there are teams where I kind of nailed that. So I'm gonna continue that sort of plan where it's like, yeah, identify a second closer, you like buy one, but don't buy one in the top 200. Just wait. You know, it was opening day and all these players were coming in with their opening day drip, and I'm never gonna look like Ellie De La Cruz and be 6'6" with that body, so I'm not gonna pull off that look. But I was really jealous of all these guys with their fitted shirts. I love the way a fitted shirt looks, so I went to Inoshino.com and got my own fitted shirt, and
you know, I got a nice flannel. I wore it to the live podcast that we did in New York and got some compliments on it. You know, what's really cool is you go through this experience where you get to, you know, customize the lapels, the linings, the monograms, the pocket flaps, anything you want. If it's a suit or a shirt, you give them your measurements and you get a shirt that fits you perfectly. It's kind of, it's bespoke without this like big price tag. $89 for fitted shirts. Suits start at $499. Just really high quality stuff. So whether it's opening day and you're at the ballpark and you're trying to interview a ball player, or you just want to look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor, when you wear Indochino, you go to Indochino.com today and use the code RATES to get 10% off of any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code RATES.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
I do think there's also a difference. We're at that point in the year where if you play draft and hold, which, you know, those are leagues where you don't get to make in-season pickups, you do have to think about this a little bit differently, especially if you're drafting in the fall or the early part of the winter when there are players haven't moved yet. You have an even smaller list of players where you kind of understand the role and the situation. So I think you go early and then you speculate late and you hope to hit. And I think that's where Seawald and Devin Williams were particularly helpful, because they still had value even if they weren't closing as often as they're closing right now. So there was another way they could be helpful in those leagues. So I think that's
like I've played some Griffin Jacks like in draft and holds. I just needed the innings. I needed some K's, you know. Didn't end up as a closer, but
yeah.
I do agree that maybe I'll take like a closer in the third round on the in drafting holds.
Camilo Doval for a second, just looking at this group, because I'm looking at that cluster of mostly misses. Lanson, we talked about me being dumb and in a league where I was just desperate, caving in. It was an important league where I should have just done something completely different, had value somewhere else. But, you know, Camilo Doval, I think, is a very good reliever. I think there's still one more level he can reach. We did see the walk rate tick up a little bit from where it was last season. The K rate is down slightly, but the home run rate improved. And we know the ballpark is good. It seems like they're pretty comfortable using him as that guy. 27 saves to me is a pretty successful season, especially for someone as young as Doval is. So I wonder if he ends up being a good value.
He has some crazy up and down over the course of the season and stuff. Plus, I don't even get it. In late August, he was throwing up 77s and stuff. Plus, what the F is going on there?
How does that happen?
I do know one thing. He started the season with lesser velo than he ended the season. And Stuff Plus really does like the last sort of 6 to 7 appearances of the season, where he's kind of living in the 140s for Stuff Plus. Just to give you a context, Emmanuel Classe was 144 for the season. So I do think that Doval has Classe-like upside, and I think that's a good name to think of, because he is a guy who throws like a 100-mile-an-hour cutter, just like Classe. It's a little bit worrisome to me that he threw his best velo at the end of the season, and in context with beat writers and Gabe Kapler having an open conversation about maybe Duvall hadn't been prepared to throw his best stuff at the beginning of the season.
Don't know.
Do you like, but it, you know, there's that I love sort of trying to read between the lines and trying to learn from those sort of things and being like, oh, you know, he doesn't prepare well over the off season. Yeah, well, he just saw the benefits of increasing his preparation and doing his arm care and just went from sitting like 97, 98 in the early season to sitting 102 at the end of the season. Maybe he saw the benefits of this. Maybe he's actually learned something from this and he's going to come in next year ready to pump 100s from the beginning of the season.
And maybe the communication in different aspects of just the relationship between player and organization will evolve to the point where they have a better plan together that can be executed on. Not that the Giants didn't.
And that's sort of how Kapler put it, you know, like, you know, we both learned from this, the course of the season. Like Duvall, like ranking Duvall versus Presley, that'll be it. That'll be difficult.
I mean, I think initially, at least, you're going to see Duvall probably ends up somewhere in the Gallegos range, like outside the top 100 overall in ADP for the early part of draft season. But you could, if we're talking about him now and the way you're talking about him as someone that throws that hard, that does have those similarities to Class A, people are going to see that and understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're gonna gradually become more and more confident in him. So I think
he'll move up draft boards.
He's gonna get into the circle.
Yeah.
And then you're gonna have a decision, probably not unlike the first time you had to really trust Jordan Romano, where you say, okay, do we really believe that he's this good? Is it okay to pay the premium? Is it okay to use pick 80, pick 85, pick 90 on Camilo Duvall and pass on some of those really good hitters?
I'm saying that maybe your circle of trust is 8, but Brian Presley and Josh Hader are at the bottom of the circle of trust, and maybe Duvall is the guy you have to take ahead of those guys.
Wow. Yeah. That is a decision I am not ready to make, which is
relievers,
tough.
The relievers, it's a hard MF in life, dude. like I was looking at this for who's the lefty in Miami? I think we've mentioned this before.
Tanner Scott?
No, it's the lefty that they just came out of nowhere-ish this year for them. I'll find him in a second. Steven Okert. Steven Okert is 31 years old. He has been pitching in an organization since 2012. He has 135 major league innings. He's a pretty good pitcher. This year they say that he was below replacement, but I don't believe it. He struck out 29% of the batters he saw this year. You know, totally usable lefty. He will be a free agent in 2027.
Oh yeah, no, he's got that's like a worse than Whit Merrifield situation.
Oh my God, dude. He's going to be a free agent in 2027, dude. I don't even know if he's going to get a free agent deal in his life. You know what I mean?
No, he should take an extension.
At that point, he'd be 36 years old. You know? Like, oh, man. And if you look at there's aging curves. Bill Petty has these excellent aging curves he did on pitching. And if you look at velo for starting pitchers and relievers, I would like someone to rerun those. I would like to see more recent aging curves for velo, given that we're like in the weighted ball driveline era, you know. I'd like to see if, you know, maybe pitchers hold on to their velo longer. But the way that it was is like everybody around 26 years old just starts losing velo, you know. And for the starting pitchers, velo just goes down, but strikeout rate doesn't go down as badly because they've got other pitches. They've got moxie. They've got feel, you know. Max Scherzer in my column today was just like yelling at me about how Stuff Plus doesn't have feel in it. And I'm like, well, it's sort of designed that way, but okay. they managed to age okay. Relievers just see their strikeout rate die with their velo. So that's what I was sort of saying with the Ryan Presley thing. We saw it. We saw the end. We previewed the end. That's what it's going to look like for him at the end of being a closer.
Well, wait a minute. I got to push back a little bit. Like, that's what we've seen historically. Now that we know that that's what happens to relievers, don't you think that we try and do things differently with relievers going forward?
Yeah. So what I'm... you mean like as a team in terms of developing them?
Right. Teams could say, wait a minute. Okay. We know as velocity drops over time that relievers become a
lot less
effective.
So we want you to have multiple
quickly.
Pitches?
Do you start to work on those second and third pitches more often with your relievers as velocity drops?
I would like to see some, but I saw no evidence that, I looked recently and I saw no evidence that relievers these days have more pitches than relievers in the past.
Which, that's the thing you would want to change. You'd say, we want our relievers to have more pitches.
Yeah, but then if they have multiple pitches in command, then why aren't they starting?
I think you want to give yourself a chance of salvaging something later.
Aging better, yeah.
Even if you only have one pitch you really trust and one that is just there to keep hitters from sitting entirely on that pitch, that's where a lot of relievers are.
Anecdotally, I'm 100% with you, and I thought that I would find something. Because you think of like Adam Ottavino adding a cutter, you know? There's a lot of pitchers that are just like, oh, I needed to add something that was in between these two pitches, you know, to make it really work. But in terms of average number of pitches thrown over 10% of the time, I couldn't find a difference between now and the past. So anyway, the way that I was going to make this relevant in terms of fantasy is that like, I will take Camilo Duvall over Ryan Pressly.
Okay. That's
helium. Romano this year. I took Romano. I know it's helium, but you know, we have this model that tells us how good people are in short samples. And we also have this fact of velo just dropping as you get older. And then we have this third fact of the pitch clocks coming in and older pitchers being slower. So it's like, this could be a kind of confluence of like the year of the young closer, you know?
I like it. I like it as a
not a great time to be Kenley Jansen, the slowest pitcher in baseball.
But I like this as a reason for sifting through some of these guys that are kind of clustered together.
Yes. I'm not going to say that like I'm going to take Clay Holmes and make him number one. Is there another example? You know, or like Duran, especially since like maybe they stretch him out or something. You know, like I'm not going to take, you know, the flavor of the month young guy and just put him all the way to the top. But if we're talking about seventh and eighth, I'm going to take the young guy, put him seventh. You know what I mean? And that's sort of what I was talking about. I think Duvall is going to end up being in that back end of Circle of Trust by the time we're drafting, you know, mains again next year.
I think that's how the market is going to treat him.
And if like Helsley goes as like the fifth best reliever next year, I want him, you know? If he goes like as the second best reliever in like the second round or third round, then I'll be like, okay, that's helium.
That's a little extreme. Right. I think the decision that everyone has to make is, are you willing to take two from the group if you're not taking one from the very beginning? Are you comfortable using
that
fifth
so
and sixth
poorly.
Round picks or some combination like that?
Oh, it was awful. That worked really poorly for me.
I think it's more of a wheel strategy. I get both picks together. I know exactly which two I'm going to get. I'm not at the mercy of someone else messing it up. You know,
still,
maybe that's
we showed how bad that was to shop in that neighborhood. Like, I think I did that once, and I even did that once where I lifted up Soto and did like Bednar Soto in like the seventh and eighth round or something. Like, jumped them, was like a max. I might have been a max pick on Bednar in that league, you know. And like I still wouldn't recommend doing that, you know.
No, I'm more like saying Pressly Duvall or some group up there where you didn't go all the way to the top, but you stayed two within that group. It's got to be the right position on the draft board to do it, but that's still tempting.
You're still trying to, like, you have all these like competing things in your head. You're like, oh, I want to come out of five rounds with two starting pitchers. Okay, well, I want to double tap on the, you know, the second level relievers. Wait. I just took four pitchers in the first five rounds.
Maybe that's the answer. Maybe it's one hitter and four pitchers.
Batflip Toby's like, yeah.
Yeah, Dalton Del Don's like, take seven straight pitchers. Like, yeah. what are you taking
any
hitters
for? Toby
does
really well with that sort of strategy. It's like, I don't know. I'd be like trying to click my body would like, they'd be like, error. Cannot click. You're like, why? Just do it.
So you mentioned earlier that we should consider embracing the committees. And I think there's kind of just a necessary evil here to do that, because if you look at year-over-year trends, I ran a simple search over at StatHead looking for number of 20 save pitchers in a season. This is going to shock absolutely no one. Last season, we only had 19 pitchers get to 20-plus saves. This year, we're sitting at 18 with 3 days left, so it's probably going to be pretty much the same number. I think there's a couple guys sitting right around that total.
Is there some other number that's going up to claim that? Is like the number of 10 saves relievers going up?
Right. This isn't just guys breaking, right? This is, you know.
Like there has been analysis that like the there's fewer teams that are giving like 95% of their chances to one player.
Let's have a look. Let's run the same search with 10 or more saves in a season and see what that trend looks like. The reason I think this is important, though, is because we, for years, for I think the first thing we've wanted to do is avoid committees. I'll just avoid it. It's a mess. We don't know who's going to get the job.
Yeah.
If this is too expensive, don't bother, because it could be a share. And the thing I've realized, the more we've seen this, is that a committee doesn't mean equal. It doesn't mean three guys are splitting the shares three even ways. It's we use this guy 3/4 of the time. We use the other guy about almost 1/4 of the time. And then the last like 5% go to this third person. That's the way we use this committee. And it's like, okay, well, if you're getting the person who's getting 3/4 of those chances, that's fine. That's still a committee, but that's still very usable. To answer your question about 10 save relievers, we're at 33 10 save relievers this season. We had 39 a year ago. We had 37 back in 2019, so 43, 40, 42. Yeah, it's pretty. This is pretty consistently the same for the last 15 years.
Well, I mean, you know, you look at some teams that, you know, are good teams that seem okay with doing bullpen by committee. The Dodgers are currently doing it. The Yankees are currently doing it. Phillies have a timeshare.
The Dodgers made a trade. Well, they had Blake Treinen, so maybe they were going to do what they did with Kimbrel with Treinen. But the Dodgers should be a committee team in theory. And they weren't until the Kimbrel failed.
Yeah. Even at the beginning of the season, I thought it would be a Treinen Kimbrel committee. That's a little bit confused by injury, though. But like the Rays go in every year, like being a committee, but then at certain parts of the year, Pete Fairbanks was the closer. The Mariners looked like they were a committee going in, and they had a really great thing, and then Sewald became their primary closer, basically. So I think that, you know, embrace the committee to me means don't be afraid of it, and pick, and those are opportunities for you to pick the winner, you're still hoping that there's a winner. And then what's nice about that, too, is, you know, you've got this model that tells you the good pitchers, you've got projections, you've got certain things you can look for to find good pitchers, and there's like the Evan Phillips phenomenon, right? Like, phenomenon, which is like, you know, Evan Phillips ended up, where did I say he ended up?
He was top 10 among closers, wasn't he?
Yes, top 10 among relievers. But it's that whole, like, do I buy Chad Green ahead of the season just to, like, have great ratios and be a valuable reliever? And at the end of the season, oh, look, Chad Green was worth $10, and you got him for $1. Like, we should buy Chad Green every year. The problem is that relievers are so volatile that even trying to buy Chad Green, maybe you bought Chad Green this year for $1. You're like, finally, I'm going to do the one where I just buy a guy who's a reliever that's not going to get me saved, but he's going to be worth $10 at the end of the season. You messed up. You know? Like, you can't always find the Chad Green. But when you buy into a closer situation, a closer committee situation, you might get just a really good reliever that only has 5 saves on the year, you know? And you might still get a lot of value out of it. So, and you're spending less.
Yeah, I think that's the key, is if you're getting these guys well outside the top 200 overall, there's plenty of value that can be had there. I think the problem with Kittredge, he got hurt. That's random. You can't control that. Players are going to get hurt. The problem with Kittredge is that he wasn't quite that cheap. He was more of a pick 150 guy, and that extra 3 or 4 rounds makes a pretty big difference. So while if he'd been healthy and got his 20 saves, I would have been really happy to get him where I got him in that auction, or $8-$10 whatever he was.
I don't really want to buy into a committee with my second closer, right?
Yeah, I think it was just a little bit too early. I think this is generally where you want to be with your third, if you can be. Otherwise, you do have to take 2 shots in and hope that you're good at this, because it's very
I'm also very not tough. Taking two shots into the same bullpen. I guess if it's my final pick, like we're talking about like real deep, my last pick, because there is the last 10 picks of your draft, you might have one or two of those guys that make it to the end of the season with you, right? So if you're talking about a 25th round pick and it's like, oh, I took Andrés Muñoz ahead, like I took Paul Sewald, let me just take Andrés Muñoz here or something. I forget who it was that we all thought would fight for saves there.
Ken Giles was in there, yeah. Because he's coming back from injury.
If you had taken Paul Sewald as your third closer, it'd be okay to take Ken Giles in one of your last three picks, you know, maybe even last five picks. Because a couple weeks in, you're like, well, now I can drop Ken Giles for a streamer or whatever, you know?
Yeah, I think that's it's a good way to look at it. And, you know, obviously we're going to look at these players in the preview in greater detail too. So if we didn't talk about a particular reliever that intrigued you this year or intrigues you next year,
yeah,
don't worry. I mean, there will be a time for that.
Especially a lot of these waiver wire helium guys, like, you know, Clay Holmes is going to be an interesting discussion in terms of looking forward. Should he be in that circle of trust? And
yeah, Bautista is easier, I think, because there's a clearer pattern of usage and the Yankees make things complicated.
What if he ends the season with knee surgery? How much does that matter? Because you could just replace the words Camilo Duvall with Felix Bautista earlier too, which now has made our circle of trust nine deep, which makes me think Hader and Presley are not in the circle of trust.
You really want to kick those guys out.
Just saying.
Yeah, well, I hate you. Someone, multiple someones will disappoint us, so trying to figure out who they are is better than just being disappointed by them and walking right into the traps.
But if I wait, my best approaches this year was getting Jordan Romano in like the sixth round. I think mostly sixth round. Jordan Romano in the six is what I want to repeat. Jordan Romano in the six, that sounds to me like Camilo Duvall or Felix Bautista in the six. That's just, you know, that it's all lining up in that same way. It's a young guy, small sample. My metrics love him. Seems like he's got the job. You know, he's not going to drop in velo next year unless it's from like 101 to 100 for Felix Bautista.
He'll be all right at 100. I think it's still going to be good.
I think it's still going to be good.
I think it's still going to be swing and miss stuff if that's what happens.
Yeah.
A couple emails to get to real quick on our way out. This one comes from Rob. Rob wanted to know, do teams have a professional pinch runner role? They were looking at ways the Mets could make room on the roster when they promoted Francisco Alvarez, and they started talking about Terrence Gore. 43 career stolen bases in 80 plate appearances.
I think he has like 7 rings. I'm not even kidding.
No.
No, come on. Hold on.
7?
How many World Series rings does Terrence Gore have?
Look, he doesn't have more than 2.
It come auto-completed on. For me.
Oh, you've okay. searched this
two.
Before.
He has 2.
How long do you think he's played?
Well, in my defense, it's recency bias because he has one in 2020 and 2021. So like, it does feel like he's had them forever.
That's ridiculous.
That was pretty good. 7-2. It's 2.
So how many teams have players
so the
like
thing
this?
About, the thing about professional pinch runners is this. Nobody has them during the course of the season, but they all want them in October. So, you know, Billy Hamilton ends up like bouncing around, DFA'd, released, signs on, minor league. And the reason is Billy Hamilton is your Terrence Gore right now, is your other option at a Terrence Gore. But nobody really wants to play him during the season in terms of where the job is like winning every day. You know, they want him for one play in October. The Dave Roberts play, you know what I mean? Like they want that moment. And it becomes a little bit more valuable in the way you construct your roster for the postseason, where there's more rest days and more things you can finagle. So they do have professional pinch runners. They do exist. They mostly only exist in October.
Rob, trying to be your friend, comes up with, maybe this is what Esturi Ruiz can become, with a smiley emoji.
Sorry, that's wouldn't that make you mad?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
It would make me very mad.
All right. I don't know if I'm that down on his stories, but maybe.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Thanks for the email.
Thanks, dude.
Really appreciate that. Multiple emails in trying to clarify a point from our last episode. Kenny G plays the soprano saxophone. So thank you to Duncan and James
was a
for
sax,
following
but
up
not
on
the
that.
Big one. It's not the big one. It's the little one, the little sax.
It's called the soprano sax. Let's proceed with the proper nomenclature of the saxophone.
Not little one?
Not the little sax.
He plays the little sax.
Plays the little sax. Like, no. That's not what Kenny G plays. It's a soprano sax. So again, thank you to Duncan and James for clarifying that.
I really do apologize to the multiple jazz. It sounds like professionals that chimed in. I think so. Like that we have multiple jazz professionals listening to this. So love you guys.
I guess tin whistle based on your description. So we clearly need all the help that we can get. Or something like this.
Not the clarinet.
No. So, if you've got questions for a future episode, especially if they are review focused, that's where we're headed for these next several weeks, you can send those our way. RatesandBarrels@theAthletic.com is the email address. You can find Eno on Twitter @EnoSaris. You can find me @DerekVanRiper. If you'd like a subscription to The Athletic and you don't have one already, $1 a month for the first 6 months, that can't be around much longer. Get it at theathletic.com/RatesandBarrels. It's going to do it for this episode of Rates and Barrels. We're back with you next week.
Thanks for listening.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.